Return to the high-action world of Bulldog Drummond. In part three of his excitement-filled life, our hero is about to face up to an unexpected turn of events. Julian Ryan Tutt is the reader.
Drummond rose. I'm completely in the dark as to your plans, but anyone who can employ a thumbscrew on a poor defenceless brute seems to me the lowest type of degraded criminal. You have kindly warned me of my danger. Let me give you a word of advice in my turn. I'm going to fight you. If I can, I'm going to beat you. Anything that may happen to me is part of the game. But if anything happens to Miss Benton during the course of operations, then as surely as there is a God above, Peterson, I'll get at you somehow and murder you with my own hands. For a few moments there was silence. Then Drummond stepped out into the warm sunshine and spoke to his chauffeur. Take her into the main road, Jenkins, and wait for me outside the entrance to the next house. I shan't be long. Then he strolled through the garden towards the little wicket gate that led to the Larches and Phyllis. The thought of her was singing in his heart. Why on earth did you come back here? Said Phyllis. Don't you realise that if anything happens to you, I shall never forgive myself? The soldier smiled reassuringly. Don't worry, he said. Years ago, I was told by an old gypsy that I should die in my bed of old age and excessive consumption of invalid port. As a matter of fact, the cause of my visit was rather humorous. They abducted me in the middle of the night with an ex-soldier of my old battalion, who was, I regret to state, sleeping off the effects of too much liquor in my rooms. What are you talking about? She said. They thought he was your American millionaire cove, and the wretched Mullings was too drunk to deny it. In fact, I don't think they ever asked his opinion at all. How splendid! Cried the girl. And where was the American? Next door, safe with a dear old friend of mine, Peter Durrell. You must meet Peter someday. You'll like him. And where's the American now? Many miles out of London, said Hugh. I think we'll leave it at that. The less you know, Phyllis, the better. And in the meantime, I want you to keep an eye on what goes on next door and let me know anything of importance by letter to the Junior Sports Club. She looked up at Drummond. I don't know whether it's worth mentioning, but yesterday afternoon, four men came at different times to the Elms. They were the sort of type one sees tub-thumping in Hyde Park. Hugh shook his head. Don't seem to help much, does it? Still, one never knows. Let me know anything like that in future at the club. Good morning, Miss Benton. Peterson's voice behind them made Drummond swing round. Our inestimable friend, Captain Drummond, brought such a nice young fellow to see me last night and then left him lying about the house this morning. Hugh bit his lip with annoyance. Until that moment, he'd clean forgotten that Mullings was still in the Elms. I have sent him along to your car, said Peterson. I'm afraid, Mullings, said Drummond, as he pulled up in front of his club in the centre of London, that the kindly gentleman with whom we spent last night refuses to meet the bill I gave him for your services. Just wait here a moment. He went inside and returned in a few moments with a folded cheque. Round the corner, Mullings. An obliging fellow in a black coat will shove you out the necessary Bradburys. The man glanced at the cheque. It's £50, sir. It's too much. The labourer, Mullings, is worthy of his hire. You have been of the very greatest assistance to me, and, incidentally, it is more than likely that I may want you again. Now, where can I get hold of you? 13 Green Street, Oxton, sir, will always find me. And any time as you wants me, sir, I'd like to come just for the sport of the thing. Hugh grinned. Good lad, and it may be sooner than you think. Inside the Junior Sports Club, Hugh Drummond was burying his nose in a large tankard of the ale as a waiter arranged the evening papers on a table. Hugh beckoned him to bring one. He glanced over the columns. Cricket, racing, the latest divorce case, the latest strike, all the usual headings. He was just putting down the paper when a paragraph caught his eye. Belfast murder. The body discovered near the docks has been identified as James Granger, confidential secretary to Hiram Potts, the American multimillionaire at present in this country. Mr. Potts, who has recently been indisposed, has returned to the Carlton and is greatly upset at the tragedy. Drummond laid the paper on his knees. Now, that's very interesting, as I was under the impression that Mr. Potts was safely tucked up in bed, consuming semolina pudding at Goring. A few minutes later, he was in the telephone box. "Peter, don't mention any names, but our guest is with you, is he? Good. I'll be down later, and we'll have a powwow." He stepped out of the box. "If, Algy," he remarked to a man who was looking at the tape machine outside, "the paper says a blighter's somewhere, and you know he's somewhere else, what do you do?" "Up to now in such cases," murmured Algy Longworth. I've always shot the editor. Come and feed." "You're so helpful, Algy. Do you want a job?" "What sort of a job?" demanded Longworth as they strolled into the luncheon room. Long after the cheese had been finished, Algy Longworth was still listening in silence to his companion. "My dear old Bean," he murmured as Hugh finished, "this is the most marvellous thing I ever heard. Enroll me as a member of the band, and incidentally, Toby Sinclair's running around in circles asking for trouble. Let's rope him in."
"Go and find him this afternoon, Algy," said Hugh, rising, "and tell him to keep his mouth shut. I'd come with you, but it occurs to me that the wretched Potts, bathed in tears at the Carlton, is in need of sympathy." "So long, old dear. You'll hear from me in a day or two."
"Mr. Potts will soon know one, sir," said the receptionist. "You are about the 20th gentleman who has been here already today." Hugh smiled genially.
"Newspaper men. I'm not. If you will have this note delivered to Mr. Potts, I think he will see me."
He sat down at the table, drew a sheet of paper towards him, and wrote rapidly. "Urgent. A message from headquarters." Then he sat back to wait. After what seemed an interminable delay, he saw the messenger crossing the lounge. "Mr. Potts will see you, sir. Will you come this way?"
When Hugh stepped inside the room, he stopped with an involuntary gasp of surprise. The man seated in the chair was Potts, to all intents and purposes. The likeness was extraordinary, and had he not known that the real article was at Goring, he would have been completely deceived. The man waited till the door was closed.
"I don't know you," he said. "Who are you?"
"Since when has everyone employed by headquarters known one another?" said Drummond.
"It wasn't like Roscoe to bungle in Belfast," said the man. "He had plenty of time to do the job properly."
"I agree," said Drummond. "The issues are far too great for any failure."
"You're right, my friend, you're right. Long live the Brotherhood."
He stared out of the window with smouldering eyes, and Hugh preserved a discreet silence. Then suddenly the other broke out again.
"Have they not killed that insolent puppy of a soldier yet?"
Not yet," murmured Hugh.
"They must find the American at once." The man thumped the table. "It was important before, at least his money was. Now with this blunder it's vital.
However, you have a message for me. What is it?"
Hugh rose. He'd got more out of the interview than he'd hoped for, and there was nothing to be gained by prolonging it. But something suddenly aroused the other's suspicions, and with a snarl of fury, he sprang past Hugh to the door.
"Who are you?"
He whipped an ugly-looking knife out of his pocket. Hugh grinned gently.
"I'm the insolent puppy of a soldier, dear old bird," he remarked,
edging towards the other man, who crouched, snarling by the door.
"The penalty of failure is death, isn't it, dear one?" he said. "Such is your rule. And I think you have failed, haven't you?
How will they kill you, I wonder?" It was at that moment that the man made his mistake. He looked away. Only for a moment, but it was enough. Quick as any dog, Hugh sprang. With his left hand, he seized the man's right wrist. With his right, he seized his throat. Then he forced him upright against the door. Little by little, the grip of his right hand tightened till the other's eyes were staring from his head.
"It would be so easy to kill you now," said Hugh, "but they know me downstairs, and it would make it so awkward when I wanted to dine here again. So, taking everything into account, I think..."
There was a sudden lightning movement, a heave, and a quick jerk. The impersonator of Potts was dimly conscious of flying through the air and of hitting the floor some yards from the door. Doubled up and groaning, he watched Hugh make for the door.
A few moments later, Hugh was crossing the tea lounge. Almost unconsciously, he glanced towards the table where 3 days before he had had tea with Phyllis Benton and had been more than half inclined to believe that the whole thing was an elaborate leg pull.
Why, Captain Drummond?
A well-known voice from a table at his side made him look down. Irma Peterson was regarding him with a mocking smile. He glanced at her companion, a young man whose face seemed vaguely familiar and whose expression was not one of unalloyed pleasure at the interruption of his tête-à-tête. Drummond bowed to her. She waved a charming hand in farewell and turned to her companion. But Drummond, though he went into the hall outside, did not immediately leave the hotel. Instead, he buttonholed an exquisite being arrayed in gorgeous apparel and led him to a point of vantage. You see that girl having tea at the third table from the Big Palm? Now, can you tell me who her companion is? I seem to know his face, but I can't put a name to it.
That's her, murmured the exquisite being, is the Marquis of Laidley. His lordship is frequently here.
Laidley, cried Hugh, the Duke of Lancashire's son. The plot thickens.
As he stepped into Pall Mall, clinging before his memory came three lines on the scrap of paper he had torn from the table at the Elms. When he had grabbed the dazed millionaire from under Peterson's nose, they included the word necklace and the word lamp. Now he saw the connection. The Duchess of Lampshire's pearls were world famous. The Marquis of Laidley was apparently enjoying his tea with Carl Peterson's daughter.
I'm glad you two fellows came down, said Hugh as he entered the sitting room of his bungalow at Goring. Dinner was over, and stretched in three chairs were Peter Tyrrell, Algy Longworth and Toby Sinclair. Two dogs lay curled up on the mat, asleep. Mrs. Denny has just told me that a man came here this afternoon. He said it was about the water, and that I told him to come. Unfortunately, I'd done nothing of the sort. His three listeners sat up and stared at him.
What do you mean, Hugh?
Asked Toby Sinclair. I should say that about 5 hours ago, Peterson found out that our one and only Hiram C. Potts was upstairs.
Good Lord, said Durrell. How the devil has he done it?
I suppose it wasn't very difficult for him to find out that I had a bungalow here.
What do we do, Sergeant Major? Said Algy.
We take it in turns, two at a time, to sit up with Potts. Hugh glanced at the other three.
Damn it, you blighters, wake up!
Durrell struggled to his feet.
I don't know what it is, he said, rubbing his eyes. I feel most infernally sleepy.
Well, listen to me, confound you. Toby,
it's far too dangerous to leave the...
His head dropped forward on his chest. A short, half-strangled snore came from his lips. It had the effect of waking him for the moment, and he staggered to his feet. The other three, sprawling in their chairs, were asleep. Even the dogs lay inert as logs.
Wake up!
Shouted Hugh.
For God's sake, wake up! We've been drugged.
An iron weight seemed to be pressing down on his eyelids. The desire for sleep grew stronger and stronger. Then, just before unconsciousness overcame him, there came to his bemused brain the sound of a whistle, thrice repeated from outside the window. With a last stupendous effort, he fought his way towards it. Dim figures were moving through the shrubs. Suddenly, one detached itself, and the light fell on the man's face. His nose and mouth were covered with a pad, but the cold, sneering eyes were unmistakable.
Lackington, gasped Hugh, and then he collapsed.
Lackington, his face pressed against the glass outside, watched in silence.
Draw the curtains, said Lackington, and one of the men did as he said. There were four in all, each with a similar pad over his mouth and nose.
Where did you put the generator, Brownlow?
In the coal scuttle.
The man carefully lifted a small black box out of the scuttle and shook it gently.
It's finished, he remarked.
Lackington dropped the box into his pocket.
Go and get him, he ordered, and tie the others up.
They left the room, and Lackington went to the window and stared down at Drummond. In his eyes was a look of cold fury, and he kicked the unconscious man savagely in the ribs.
You young swine! Do you think I'll forget that blow on the jaw?
All right, he's in the car.
A voice came from outside the window, and Lackington turned away.
Then we'll go. Au revoir, my blundering young bull. Before I've finished with you, you'll scream for mercy, and you won't get it.
On arrival at the Junior Sports Club next morning, the four men sank into four large chairs and pondered gently on the vileness of the morning after, especially when there hadn't been a night before. As luncheon was announced, Hugh got to his feet. Are we better?
No, murmured Toby. But I am beginning to hope that I may live. Four martinis, and then we'll gnaw a cutlet.
Has it struck you, fellows, remarked Hugh at the conclusion of lunch, that seated round this table are four officers who fought with some distinction and much discomfort in the recent historic struggle, and that last night we were done down, trampled on, had for mugs, by a crowd of dirty blackguards?
A veritable Solomon, said Algy, gazing at him admiringly through his eyeglass.
Has it still further struck you, went on Hugh, that we aren't standing for it? I propose that we should tackle the blighters tonight.
Tonight, echoed Durrell. Where?
At the Elms, of course. That's where the wretched Potts is, for certainty.
And how do you propose that we should set about it? Demanded Sinclair.
Drummond drained his port and grinned gently.
By stealth, dear old Beans. You, and I thought we might rake in Ted Jerningham and perhaps Jerry Seymour to join the happy throng, will make a demonstration in force with the idea of drawing off the enemy, thereby leaving the coast clear for me to explore the house for the unfortunate Potts.
What do you mean by a demonstration? Said Longworth.
Pay attention, all of you, said Hugh. Tonight, sometime about 10 o'clock, Algy's motor will proceed along the Godalming Guildford Road. It will contain you three, also Ted and Jerry Seymour, if we can get them. On approaching the gates of the Elms, you will render the night hideous with your vocal efforts. Stray passers-by will think that you are tight. Then will come the dramatic moment when, with a heavy crash, you ram the gate.
How awfully jolly, said Algy. I beg to move that your car be used for the event.
Can't be done, old son, said Hugh. I'll be wanting it myself. Now, to proceed. Horrified at this wanton damage to property, you will leave the car and proceed in mass formation up the drive. Either Ted or Jerry, or both, will approach the house and inform the owner in heartbroken accents that they have damaged his gatepost. You three will remain in the garden. You might be recognised. Then it will be up to you. You'll have several men all around you. Keep them occupied. I think that 10 minutes will be enough for me. I may find Potts, I may not. But when you have given me 10 minutes, you clear off. I'll look after myself. Now, is that clear? Hugh stopped his car at Guildford Station and strolled restlessly up and down. He looked at his watch a dozen times in 2 minutes. Over the telephone, he had arranged that she should come by train from Godalming to confer with him on a matter of great importance. She had said she would, but what was it? He, having no suitable answer ready, had made a loud buzzing noise and rung off. And now he was waiting. At length, the train was signalled, and Hugh got back into his car. He scanned the faces of the passengers as they came out into the street, until, with a sudden, quick jump of his heart, he saw her, cool and fresh, coming towards him with a faint smile. "What is this very important matter you want to talk to me about?" she demanded as he adjusted the rug round her. It was chilly in the open-top sports car.
"I'll tell you when we get out on the hog's back," he said, slipping in his clutch. "It's absolutely vital."
Once or twice he'd looked at her out of the corner of his eye. Except for their first meeting at the Carlton, it was the only time he had ever had her completely to himself, and Hugh felt as if he could go on driving forever, just he and she alone. He had an overwhelming longing to take her in his arms. It was then that the girl turned and looked at him. "Let's stop," she said. "Then you can tell me." Hugh drew into the side of the road and switched off the engine. If the girl saw his hand trembling a little as he opened the door, she gave no sign. He came and stood beside her, his arm lying along the seat just behind her shoulders. "Tell me about this important thing," she said. He smiled, and no woman yet born could see Hugh Drummond smile without smiling too. "You darling," he whispered. "You adorable darling." His arm closed around her, and almost before she realized it, she felt his lips on hers. For a moment she sat motionless, then, with a little gasp, she pushed him away. "You mustn't, Hugh." "And why not, darling? Don't you know I love you?"
"But it's only 2 or 3 days since we met," she said.
"And what the devil has that got to do with it at all?" he demanded. She felt herself lifted bodily out of the car and lying in his arms, with Hugh's eyes looking very tenderly into her own. With a sudden, quick movement, she put both her arms round his neck and kissed him on the mouth. "Is that good enough?" she asked. At 9:45, he backed his car into the shadow of some trees, not far from the gate of the Elms. The sky was overcast, which suited his purpose, and through the gloom of the bushes he dodged rapidly towards the house. From a downstairs room on one side came the hoarse sound of men's voices, and he placed that as the smoking room of the gang of ex-convicts and blackguards who formed Peterson's staff. There was one bedroom light at the back of the house, and thrown on the blind he could see the shadow of a man. As he watched, the man got up and moved away, only to return in a moment or two and take up his old position. "It's one of those 2 bedrooms, he muttered to himself, if he's here at all. Crouching in the shadow of some shrubs, he peered at his watch. It was just 10:00. The trees were creaking gently in the faint wind. All around him, the strange night noises were whispering and muttering. And once again, the thrill of the night stalker gripped him. He remembered the German who had lain motionless for an hour in a little gully, while he, from behind a stunted bush, had tried to locate him. And then that one creak as the Boche had moved his leg. And then the end. No, the night held no terrors for him, only a fierce excitement. At last, faintly in the distance, he heard the hum of a car. Rapidly it grew louder, and he smiled grimly to himself as the sound of 5 unmelodious voices singing lustily struck his ear. They passed along the road in front of the house. There was a sudden crash, then silence, but only for a moment. Peter's voice came first.
"You priceless old ass, you've rammed the blinking gate!"
It was Jerry Seymour who then took up the ball.
"Ah, we must go and apologise to the owner. Quite unpardonable. You can't go about country knocking down gates."
Half-consciously, Hugh listened, but now that the moment for action had come, every faculty was concentrated on his own job. He saw 6 men go rushing out into the garden through a side door, and then 2 more ran out and came crashing past him. For an instant, he wondered what they were doing. A little later, he was destined to find out. Then came a peal at the front doorbell, and he determined to wait no longer. He darted through a door to find a flight of back stairs in front of him, and in another moment he was on the 1st floor. He walked rapidly along the landing. Turning a corner, he found himself at the top of the main staircase, the spot where he had fought Peterson 2 nights previously. He walked quickly onto the room, which he calculated was the one where he had seen the shadow on the blind. He flung the door open. There, lying in the bed, was the American, while crouched beside him, with a revolver in his hand, was a man. The man leapt up and raised his revolver. Then the unexpected happened. A jet of liquid ammonia struck him full in the face. With a short laugh, Hugh dropped his water pistol in his pocket and turned his attention to the bed. Wrapping the millionaire in a blanket, he picked him up and, paying no attention to the man gasping and choking in a corner, he raced for the back stairs. Down he ran and into the garden. Everything had fallen out exactly as he hoped, but had hardly dared to expect. He heard Peterson's voice in the house behind him, calm and suave as usual, answering Jerry. Not a soul was in sight. The back of the house was clear. All he had to do was walk quietly through the wicket gate to the larches with his semi-conscious burden, get to his car and drive off. It all seemed so easy. But there were one or two factors that he had forgotten. The first was the man upstairs. The window was thrown up suddenly, and the man leaned out, waving his arms, still gasping with the strength of the ammonia. Then, from the trees close by, there came the sharp clang of metal. With a quick catch at his breath, he began to run. Now, the two men who had rushed past him before he entered the house had become the principal danger. As he ran on, he heard something crash into a bush on his right and give a snarl of anger. Like a flash, he swerved into the undergrowth on the left. Then began a dreadful game. He was still some way from the fence, and he was hampered at every step by the man slung over his back. He could hear the thing blundering about, searching for him. Suddenly, with a cold feeling of fear, he realised that the animal was in front of him, that his way to the gate was barred. The next moment, it came out into the open, and he saw it, and he knew it had seen him. Grotesque and horrible, it crouched on the ground. He could hear its heavy breathing as it waited for him to move. Cautiously, he lowered the millionaire to the ground and took a step forward. It was enough. With a snarl of fury, the crouching form rose and shambled towards him. Two hairy arms shot towards his throat. He smelt the brute's fetid breath, hot and loathsome, and he realised what he was up against. It was a partially grown gorilla. For a full minute they fought in silence, save for the hoarse grunts of the animal as it tried to tear away the man's hand from its throat and then encircle him with its powerful arms. With his brain cold as ice, Hugh kept his head. There was only one chance of finishing it quickly, the grip taught him by the Japanese olaki. He shifted his left thumb an inch or two on the brute's throat. Then, little by little, the fingers moved, and the grip, which had been tight before, grew tighter still. Back went its head. Something was snapping in its neck. With a scream of rage, it wrapped its legs round Drummond, squeezing and writhing. And then suddenly there was a tearing snap, and the great limbs relaxed and grew limp. With a gasp of utter exhaustion, the man dropped on the ground himself. He was utterly cooked. Even Peterson's voice close behind scarcely roused him. Quite one of the most amusing entertainments I've seen for a long time. He looked up wearily, and he saw that he was surrounded by men.
That was Chapter 3 of Bulldog Drummond by Herman McNeil. It was read by Julian Rind-Tutt. The producer was John Simpson, and it was abridged by Neville Teller. And